Have you ever heard about the BGG Awards?
No, I've never heard about the BGG Awards.
Let me tell you about the BGG Awards. They are awards from a website called BGG, or also known as Board Game Geek. Now, when you go to these awards, as any BGG user, you can nominate things like your favorite light game or favorite strategy game or favorite board game podcast. Now, I'm just saying, you know, people should go and vote for their board game podcast, favorite board game podcast, whatever that podcast might be.
That was a bit of a Freudian slip there, because you said people should go and vote for their board game podcast.
Well.
Because that's what you were thinking in your head.
I mean, as any good citizen, I will go and vote.
I'm not voting for us. I've got ones I prefer.
Okay. But the thing that you should also know, that there's two times you need to vote. You can go and vote once, and then they'll tally up the results and then narrow the selection down to 10, and then you have to go and vote again. It's a two-vote process. So please, go and vote. Do a thing, put a tick down or whatever. It's not an actual tick. There's like a menu you select and then...
Whoever you do vote for, you'll probably make their day, so...
Yeah, exactly, right? There you go. So, BGG Awards, link in the description. Thank you very much.
Welcome to Talk Cardboard, a podcast about board games and everything adjacent, with me, Elaine, and you...
Me, Efka.
On today's episode, we'll be brining it up at the Lithium Party in Salton Sea and rolling our way into a mini space opera in Arx.
And I would just like to mention that none of these are review copies because we are independent from publisher support. In fact, one of these games is so not a review copy, we don't even have a copy. Haha.
Well, that's true.
Right?
Uh-huh. We'll get to that in a bit when we talk about that game.
And also, they're all just first impressions. We're just sharing our first impressions. We have more salient coverage on our YouTube channel.
Nice.
No pun included, which you can type into YouTube and you will find us. And also, you can support this sort of independent board game reviewership by going to patreon.com/nopunincluded, where you'll get bonus episodes of this very podcast.
First, though, Sai has written in. They say, I enjoyed your take on Wormspan and in particular Elaine's reaction to the Book of Dragon Facts. The standard versions of Wingspan include the equivalent on the bird card themselves, and it was at least partly a question of accessibility and readability that moved this purely flavour text away from the table and into the book. There's a fascinating blog on BGG about more visually accessible versions of Wingspan and how that fed into Wormspan. Though Rolling with Two's review suggests that the graphic design has only been partially successful in those terms. Anyway, I think it's interesting that the industry and the critical space are mature enough now to be increasingly transparent about factors beyond a platonic ideal of play. Pragmatic manufacturing costs, environmental impact, political ideology, accessibility considerations, and so on. Thanks for the videos and podcasts. And they did provide the links to those things as well, so that I could look at them.
And will you share them in the episode description?
I sure will.
Okay.
I watched the Rolling With Two video on the accessibility of Wormspan and Wingspan versus Wingspan, right? And it was interesting because one of the things that they said was something that you said. So on the tiny dragons, I can't remember what they're called, hatchlings.
Yes.
Hatchlings. Some of the milk icons are really hard to differentiate because there is not like a background banner that goes... behind all of the milks,
right?
All of the milk icons. So even as someone who isn't visually impaired, it was hard to know, is that two or three, or like, what do they mean by this? The iconography was muddled. And I think that's a good example of how accessibility in games or in anything can filter down, I guess, into benefit for everyone.
Well, I think it's also, a duty then of reviewers to comment on things like that, because I think it is common for first printings to make mistakes. I applaud Stonemaier for, you know, iterating and changing things, you know, recognizing deficits within their visual graphic design and improving them in subsequent versions, right? I'm hoping that a subsequent republishing of Wormspan can also address these issues. And it is through criticism like that that we can actually, you know, engage conversations about this and sometimes inform the publisher. Strangely, I believe Jamie Stegmaier does not watch reviews of his games anymore.
Which is understandable.
Yeah, which is fair, right? So I don't know how that filters down, how criticism filters down to him then, but clearly they do have processes to make changes.
And I think that's the important point, isn't it? That you might start with something, but then you incrementally try and make it better and you listen to what people are saying. And like, even for me, having I didn't even realize there were blurbs on each of the birds in Wingspan, because I was so like concentrating on how to play the game and what to do with the game. I don't have visual problems, but I have some processing problems sometimes. Mm-hmm. And so having all of that information, I was concentrating on the information that I needed to know to be able to play the game, not information that was fluff, essentially, like for my brain, that would take up space in my brain. So having it in a booklet in Wormspan is much more like having, you know, like a spotter's guide to birds or worms or dragons or whatever. It's much nicer and more comfortable for me to be able to just peruse that at my leisure than have to kind of do it in the moment of the game.
Well, I think it comes from, again, established practices, because the little blurbs on the bird cards were like, they were flavor text. It was literally like one sentence,
yes,
you know?
Yeah, and they just took up space on the cards. That was the kind of accessibility thing that meant there was a chunk of the card that actually didn't help you.
No, you know, I know, right? But it comes from Magic the Gathering. And it is like, I don't know. I think we've known for a long time that flavor text is often ignored, right? And I wonder, you know, if it is because we've always just printed flavor text without thinking about it, you know, and not thinking about whether we could do it in a different, better way, you know, where it's like a supplemental lore guide. I'm thinking of like fantasy games now, because flavor text, I think, probably comes from Magic the Gathering. I'm sure other games before that like had flavor text on cards, but it's the one that popularized the idea. That game was published in the 90s. Maybe it's time to, you know, like, think about better ways of doing things. I like that booklet of Dragon Facts, because like during the game we did bring it out until we got overwhelmed, right? Like, no, there's too much mechanisms to think about now. Like, let's put the booklet aside. But it was fun, you know. But also, I don't know. It just felt like such a different approach, and so it stuck out immediately. Like, here's a book of dragon facts. You know, so yeah, it was cool. I liked it.
Thank you to Sai for writing in about that, and also a quick shout out to colorblindgames.com and Rolling With Two for making videos and articles on accessibility issues in board games. Talking of books though, right, I just want to say thank you to everyone who has emailed me with books that are board game themed or stories from board games, right? I'm not going to read them all out because there was a lot of them, and I really, really appreciate that. I've made a note of all of them, and I will check them all out. But so thank you to James, Pete, Rich, Jim, and Arvid for sending in emails about all the different kinds of stories from board games.
Are you going to read all those books now?
I'm definitely going to check out some of them, yeah. Yeah, I'm going to try.
Okay.
See which ones
well,
I like
good
and,
luck.
And which ones I do not like. Let's talk about our first game, though. Salt and Sea comes from publisher De Vere by David Bernal with art by Amelia Salas. So,
well, this is a funky game because So first of all, let's get one thing out of the way. Last year, we made a video covering White Castle by De Vere Games, in which we have jokingly said it's no pipeline, right? Whereas the games aren't similar at all, but that was kind of part of the joke. Long story short, De Vere Game publishes, I'm sure this was in plans long before we made that joke, so unrelated, publishes a game that is, at least theme-wise, very adjacent to Pipeline, and it is a more hefty economic simulator in about the same size of a box as White Castle, which, if you've seen that box, you will know, or any boxes published by De Vere Games, It's quite small. It's a tiny box. It packs a lot of game in a tiny box.
Almost so that it doesn't fit back in the box.
Almost, almost. You can bin the rule books that you don't want, and then you will be able to fit the game. Because there are like 5 different rule books in different languages. So you only need one of them, presumably. Maybe 2. So Salt and Sea is about extracting lithium and geothermal energy in an area in California called Salt and Sea. As the rulebook explains, this area is special because of a cavalcade of various natural occurring and man-made events that make Salt and Sea a place that is unique and the only place in the world, I think, that we're aware of where you can extract both lithium and geothermal energy simultaneously. Now, this is a heady subject, and we will probably save the discussion of the theming of Salt and Sea for the latter part of the review. Let's just talk a little bit about what this game is and, you know, how it works and that kind of thing. So it's an economic euro, basically. You are playing as freelance operatives that are getting into the mining game of extracting lithium and geothermal energy from Salt and Sea. You will basically be buying drilling licenses and then drilling to extract brine, which you will then convert into geothermal energy and lithium, and then you will sell that to the free corporations in the game, manipulating their share value, shares which you can purchase as well. And through these various means, you will acquire victory points. And at the end of the game, whoever has the most will win. The funky thing about this game is, and honestly, the thing that appealed to me about it, is this idea that the money is your actions. There are, I think, 13 different actions in the game. And they're all very granular, like buy a license to drill, process the brine, you know, into other things like lithium and geothermal energy, sell the geothermal energy and lithium, complete contracts, get research, so on and on and on. But all of these things revolve around money. And money is these double-sided cards in the game. So there is like, there's ones, there's threes and fives, right? And on the back of the card, it literally says $1, $3, $5, or whatever, right? But on the other side of the card is an action that you can do by playing the card from your hand and putting one of your workers on it. Now, that action is usually representative of an action you can already do on your player board. So, for example, if I wanted to process the brine that I have into lithium, you know, I could do that on my player board, but maybe I have an action card that makes it cheaper for me to process it or lets me process more of it. You know, there's various, like, benefits and bonuses that you get. But then that money is effectively taken out of your hand for the round until the end of the round, where it returns back to your hand. However, you also need to pay for the things that you are doing. So, for example, the same action, processing lithium, like brine into lithium, it's not just free. You have to pay a lot of money. You have to pay 6 money specifically for lithium, right? So you need to discard either like 6 ones or 1 5 and 1 1 or 2 3s. Mm-hmm. And then they go into this kind of shared pile of money that you can then pick back up from, or maybe not if the money is gone, right? Because there's no change in this game, right? So if something costs 8 and you have 2 5s, then that's all your money. You have to pay the 2 5s, and that's you don't get any change, right? And when you get money, you have to pick either from the available display where you can see what the actions are, or from the money people that, like, they've discarded. But if everyone's picked all the ones, for example, right, there are no ones, and you just got like $2 for something, well, you got no money, right? Because there is no money. It's very bizarre. It's a really cool action selection mechanism. I guess it's just an innovative action selection mechanism, isn't it? But I really liked it. This is the thing that appealed to me about the game. Because it made you make weird considerations and was cool. And I wish someone took that mechanism and put it in a different game than Salt and Sea, because I didn't like the rest of it at all. And neither did you, I believe. Would you like to brief us on how the rest of it works, Elaine, or what you didn't like about it?
This game made me angry, and I don't know why. It did not make me feel good in a way that when you're playing a game and you're trying your best to get the things that you need and that you want to do. I told you, I felt like I was Sisyphus pushing the rock up the hill, right? And then, but no, it came down every time. And I felt like I was inching forward just to move like a meter back every time. Like, I found it so incredibly frustrating. And I appreciate that that was probably just how I was playing the game, and it wasn't the game itself, but that was my experience of the game. And I don't think that's going to be everyone's, but that was mine. I just found it so, like, wading through treacle all the time. Everything that I was doing was so small and gave me such little, like, I ended up selling brine quite a lot because it was costing so much money to get the mining license, then drill down, and then I didn't have any money to convert the brine into anything else, so I just had to sell the brine as it was. And then I was also trying to buy shares in companies, but they were getting incrementally more expensive because every time you sell to a company, that company goes up in price. So if you want to buy a share in it. So everything, I was so hampered by like just not having enough money to do anything that I wanted to do. And I know that you did not have that experience.
There was no fun in punishment is what I wanted to say for you, right?
Right. So if you compare it to something like Pipeline, it's nothing like Pipeline, but you know, if you're comparing it to a game that does have those moments.
Did you say it's no Pipeline?
No, I did say it. But what is Pipeline? I mean, a game that has those moments of, I want to do this, but to do this, I need to do that. And to do that, I need to do this. That kind of like, no. I've never come across a game so much where there didn't seem to be a way out of that. And I ended up taking that horrible action that no one ever wants to take where you get a dollar.
Right.
You know? Okay, yeah. And I kept having to do that because I just but yeah, you didn't have that experience. Please tell me more about your experience of that game.
I had that experience less than you, but I still had that experience. I think it's baked into the game, right? And I think part of what I didn't like about it is this sense of linearity, right? So I've described the process, right? You buy a drilling license, which is a card you put like underneath your player board, and it sort of trails off, and this little wooden drill, and
it's cute.
It's really very cute, right? And then when you drill, you move the drill down onto the card and past the card. Now there might be some rocks and there might be some brine potential on that card, and then if you hit some rocks, your drill gets damaged, which you need to pay money to repair. And again, money is very scarce. My. And you need to pay for the drilling license, right? Okay, so you paid money. You maybe damaged your drill, so you'll need to pay money later to fix that. But you've gotten to the brine. Then you need to extract it. By default, you can extract one brine unless you have a money card that lets you extract more. So, okay, there's more money out of your hand, right? Potentially. Okay, cool. So if you extracted the brine, you have some brine. How much brine could you extract? Oh, you could extract 3 brine. Oh, that's very cool. There's only space in the warehouse for 2 brine unless you upgrade the. Okay, right. So you've got the 2 brine. Great. Cool. Okay. Now you need to process that into lithium or geothermal energy so you can actually sell it for more money. Okay, let's do that. That costs money. Right. Cool. Okay. And so then after that, you can sell it. Now, the way you sell it, and this is where the linearity splits, but not in an interesting way, because you either sell it to the companies, which pay you a decent chunk of money. You can actually make a profit on that and kind of what you should be doing at the beginning of the game. The other way to sell it is contracts. It gives you much less money, but it might give you like a cool bonus and, more importantly, victory points. that is the non-profitable way of doing things, but the victory points is what matters, which is kind of bizarre because that's not how that would work in real life. You would want to sell it for the money, right?
I mean, but what is, like, of the real life victory points?
Yeah. So
having money, I guess.
Right. Anyway, so...
Or is it being happy?
From mining all the... Let's save the thematic discussions for later. And that's kind of the dichotomy. You go, okay, so am I beginning the game? I sell it to companies. Maybe I buy like a share or whatever. And then when you sell it to companies, you can pick up some of the really cool 5 cards, right? And then some of them you have a spending money, and some of them you probably pick up like as kind of discounts on actions or more effective actions. And then you kind of save that and use that every round. For example, there's also research cards you can get, which are general upgrades and a source of victory points. So if you get a card that says, oh, here's a -$3 discount on research cards, that's very effective. And so you try to not spend that card for doing things, rather spend it every turn as a recursive action to propel you along the way. But it's very linear in that way, right? Because you go, oh, okay, I've done those things. Now I guess I'll spend some of that money I've earned on, you know, completing these contracts and propelling myself further on the victory point track. And maybe somewhere along the way, I'll buy some cheap shares and hopefully that company's, you know, share value goes up. And then, you know, there's more victory points that way. So it's there's a very linear progression, which is weird because the action selection system, I think, is very interesting. But also, all of it is very busy to do a very kind of rote thing.
Right, yeah. So, okay, yeah, going back to what you were saying, like, I liked how the cards were laid out. So often in a game, you have a kind of market area where you can buy things from or choose things from, cards or whatever. So this was interesting in that you could choose from those when you earned money. You could choose from those, or you could just take, you know, potluck on what someone had already discarded. I quite like that because it gave you a choice of either take these and being able to choose whether to take the 5s, 3s, or 1s if you know how much you made. So there were times when you might want to take a lot of 1s or a couple of 3s or 1 5, you know what I mean? To try and work out how you can most effectively use them. So I quite like the idea of that, but everything was so small and so far away, right? And I said to you that if these cards were big enough to be functional for seeing the icons on them, the game would have taken up our entire living room floor. It wouldn't have just been the squeezed on the table, but it would have taken up the entire living room.
Yeah.
There was a lot of artwork on the cards while it was lovely and pretty, it took up space that the icons could have taken up, honestly. Like, that's how I felt, because I don't know if we could have turned the board the other way around, but certainly we played it as a 3-player game. So there was always going to be someone that was far away from them and asking, what does this card do? What does this card do? What, like, because you just couldn't see them from how far away
I couldn't
were.
See what the cards were.
No,
at all.
And it was so pivotal of what you took and what you needed. They were so important because they had these upgraded actions that you could do, or they did different things, or they gave you victory points, or whatever they did. It was so important, and they were just so, and there were so many of them because there were 3 different markets, because there was the 5s, the 3s, and the 1s. And there was also another 2 markets of contracts and research. And it was so overwhelming for my tiny brain to try and figure out what I wanted to do.
Yeah, there's 25 cards plus the random discard piles, right?
Yeah, that was too much for me. It wasn't like the actions themselves I thought were pretty simple and interesting and well laid out. Like your player boards themselves were clear, but that was impenetrable for me.
Yeah, I think there's maybe just 1 too many actions in the game, or 2 too many, or maybe 3 too many.
I don't know.
The process is so granular, right? Like, because there is no way to zero in on this in a cohesive strategy, like collect like a conglomerate of cards that like propels you in a certain direction. You have to be flexible and fluid at all times, because it's like, what am I doing this round? Well, probably getting some mining licenses and drilling, because, you know, so I want to have those cards, right? But then I want to get rid of those cards because they're not useful to me. And I want to get some cards that give me discounts on processing and like give me more money for selling. But then I want to get rid of those cards. Like, you can't have everything. So you kind of want to like somehow fluidly flow through this market.
It's really hard.
It's incredibly hard.
Yeah.
A lot of the time you find yourself like, I just don't have the right cards. So maybe I'll stall.
Right.
And see if better cards come out.
And I think I'm right in thinking that all the cards, like each market had cards for all the different actions in them. It wasn't like fives only have actions for
Correct.
Drilling. So it was so busy. Like, so we just played Nucleum as well, which we will talk about in the future at some point, not now. But after we played that, which is, if you don't know Nucleum, it's very much sort of in the same brain space as Brass. So there's a lot going on, but...
But also Salt and Sea, because they're both like industrial economic Euro games.
Sure, yes. But after we played that and then played Salt and Sea, I said, wow, Nucleum is so clean feeling compared to Salt and Sea, because everything just made a lot more sense. It was a lot tighter in Nucleum because, for example, let me give you an example.
Which is, sorry, just to interrupt, it's counterintuitive because Nucleum is color vomit.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah, it is.
And Salt and Sea is an incredibly clean graphic design.
But, like, for example, with in Nucleum and in Salt and Sea, there are two different things that you can do with tiles or cards, right? So in Salt and Sea... your card either can be used as an action, in which case you'll get it back, or it can be used as money, in which case you won't get it back. In Nucleum, your rail tiles are your action tiles. So you can either use it as an action tile and get it back, or you can use it as a rail tile, in which case you will not get it back. And what the interesting thing there was, the decision space in which tiles you spend, because which ones do I want to get back? Which ones do I not care about that I can maybe buy some later on? Whereas in Salt and Sea, there was none of that decision because I was spending, like, even when I wanted to keep a card back, I was having to spend it because I was so short of money. But you had a different experience, I think, again.
Well, yeah, again, I try to you know, prop myself up with more liquidity, I guess, in that way. And so I had spare money that I could, you know, rely on to have in the future where I to need it. But then again, I kind of I got overconfident and and put myself in a hole where I'm just like, oh, okay, I have no money now. So it, again, less than you, but also did happen to me. But I think it's funny that you mentioned Nucleum in that regard. And both have like actions that you can spend permanently, right? In a industrial economic Eurogame simulator that's to do with
energy
sources, right? Weird. Anyway, the tiles in Nucleum are so much smaller. They're like, you know, like five matchsticks put together versus like a card, right? And somehow the iconography manages to be so much more clear. And you can immediately see, oh, I need this and that. And like, yeah, I know what's going on here. And in Salt and Sea, it's just so hard to pass, right?
And some of the icons actually are quite similar. There are two icons, and I can't remember. One is for a contract for drilling, I think, and one is for a contract for the companies.
For selling,
and
yeah.
And they look almost identical.
They do.
Except one has a tiny blue border and one has a tiny red border. But no.
Yeah. No. Okay, so it's a game that's frustrating to play. It's a game that's very rote and granular and procedural, right? And linear. So I wish that the dynamism of this action selection system was present in the rest of the game. Because the rest of the game isn't particularly interesting.
And it was long.
And it was way over long. It dragged on, right? So, okay, so we alluded to thematic elements. So there is a foreword which is quite long in the rulebook that explains why Salt and Sea is important. And whilst I applaud De Vere Games for putting in a foreword which is way longer than most board games, and that's sort of appreciated, I took some umbrage with the focus of that forward and how the setting is presented within the game itself, right? So first of all, I want to say I have no problem with like games that deal with contentious topics and even deal with them in a kind of a way where it doesn't comment on it. Like we mentioned liking Pipeline. That game is just about refining crude oil, right?
There's no saving grace.
No, there's nothing there, right? It's just brutally bleak, right? And actually what I liked about Pipeline is that aesthetically, it doesn't shy away from that. It just says, hey, this is brutally bleak, because I think there's something to be learned from that, you know? I, as a person, will never experience the process that is refining crude oil. The closest approximation I can get to that is watching a documentary and learning about it that way, but that doesn't insert me as an active participant in the process. What a board game can do is it can teach you, and I appreciate that there is a lot of people who just don't want to learn that because they don't need that experience in their life. And 100% yes, right? There are a lot of experiences that I don't want to be a part of, and like there are just like I feel cooey and icky about, right? For some reason, this isn't one, even though the subject matter to me is incredibly cooey and icky. So, you know, to each their own kind of thing, right? So I have no objection to the game that is presented in Salt and Sea. What I have an objection, and not so much an objection, but more like kind of, I wish they didn't go that way, is how the subject is presented. So this forward basically says, hey, lithium is a great source of renewable energy to make the world go greener. And this place, Salt and Sea, you can mine geothermal energy, which is, unlike other renewable energy like wind and solar, is constant. And also, you know, lithium can then, you know, be powered via this geothermal energy, green energy, right? Like, this is good, right? We should extract this. Mm-hmm. 5 minutes of Googling is all it took me, right? Yeah. Like, five minutes of Googling. And I've obviously Googled more than 5 minutes. I try to educate myself as a layman as much on the subject. And the problem isn't that any of that isn't true, right? Because it is true, right? All of that is theoretically true. The problem is that the rulebook just shows you one side of it. And that side is, hey, this place exists. We can mine both together. And it's great. It can be, but here's some problems. So the reason, one of the predominant reasons why you would mine lithium, especially in relation to it being a renewable energy, is lithium ion batteries, which are used in electric vehicles, cell phones, laptops, etc., etc. Right? Now saying, and the rulebook says lithium is the predominant ingredient in these, right? Saying that lithium is the predominant ingredient in lithium-ion batteries is like saying that bread is the predominant ingredient of pizza. It's not untrue. It is. I've made pizza. There's also some other key ingredients that are very important, and you can't make pizza without. And for lithium-ion batteries, that's cobalt. Now, cobalt mining, on the other hand, is just horrendous. It is absolutely awful. And I suggest... there's an article from 2016 in Washington Post deals with cobalt mining. Maybe it's gotten better since, but it doesn't look like it. I don't want to go into the subjects of that article because it's pretty bleak, grim stuff.
I feel like the game presents it very, very one-sided. It's presenting a dream as reality. Like, because, yeah, sure, maybe it is ecologically sound, but it's not ecologically sound right now, because the mining of lithium or the brining of to get the lithium causes all kinds of problems, sulfur dioxide problems, it poisons the water, it poisons the fish, it poisons agriculture. It's horrendous.
Yes. Like, so the thing about it is that when they extract this brine, the idea in Salt and Sea is that
sulfuric acid as well.
Yeah. So the way they get geothermal energy is they basically look for geothermal vents that are close to the surface of the earth, and the temperature is pretty high there, and then they can get that water, which is basically steam. It powers geothermal plants, right? Okay, so and Salt and Sea specifically on the fork of the San Andreas Fault. So when you are drilling into the San Andreas Fault. The consequences are not really known as to what might happen there. So there's one problem. The other problem is that that brine is full of sulfuric acid, mm-hmm. right? You are releasing that into the environment. Like you said, you're poisoning mm-hmm. stuff, right? But on top of that, the area where Salton Sea is located is quite impoverished and immigrant high. And a lot of immigrants travel there for agriculture jobs because the area is predominantly known for agriculture. Mm. Now, it is very much likely that all of this activity could poison and make the territory infertile in terms of agriculture, right? And that could affect the local population and jobs. Now, the inverse of that is that, of course, the free mining companies that are operating in the area, you know, they're saying we're going to create jobs, but you are literally leaving that in the hands of mining companies,
yes.
which are yeah. not known to be socially responsible, right?
No, they are not.
And the final problem as well is that these companies, so there's this method of, okay, so because there's a lot of lithium in the area, and that's what makes Salton Sea unique, it can produce geothermal energy via the water like that pumps out, and that water is also brine, so which is rich in lithium.
Yeah.
So the idea is that, okay, so blast of...
It's a loop.
Yeah, blast of water, we capture that water, we filter it for lithium, we release it back out, right?
Nice.
Cool, nice. In theory, in practice, they can't do this yet.
No.
One of the companies themselves have described the process as trying to drink out of a fire hose, which means that basically they can't tame this water yet. They can't extract lithium from it properly yet. But everyone's congregating in the area, buying up land, territory,
yeah.
building stuff, trying to do this in the hopes that it will power electric vehicles, which are currently, you know, do have, they are a renewable source of power, but only if you don't power them, recharge them via gas, right?
Or coal, yeah.
Or coal. And technically, lithium-ion batteries are recyclable when they reach the end of their lifespan. But no
they are
one,
not recycled.
They're not recycled currently.
For the most part, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because it's very hard to do that and it's very costly to recycle them.
Yeah.
So then it's not done.
So I don't have objection to the game. And I, like, or its setting, right? I just wish that this forward didn't say...
Mm.
Oh, hey, this is great and green when the reality is much bleaker and starker. Just put that in. You know, it gives the game so much more context and lets you learn so much. I feel like Salton Sea as a box, as it is delivered to me, is misinformation, right? Like, not maybe, I don't want to ascribe any malice or anything like that, but it just feels, you know, like maybe incompetence, you know, where it's just like, sorry, this is a harsh word.
That is a harsh word.
I don't really mean, but like to use the analogy, you know, not malice, but incompetence. But something like that, where it's like, you know, they put some information in, but they could have done more, right?
Why? When it is so very easy to find out this information. Like, it's not going to... Do they think it's going to hamper people's enjoyment of the game if they say that this is what is happening and this is why it's quite bleak, but this is what the game is about?
Well, the artwork isn't bleak. There's a lot of really nice, colourful artwork of, like, you know, mining rigs and stuff like that in the sea, right? And I think maybe it's somewhat telling that it doesn't show, you know, any local people or anything like that. And the game is called Salton Sea, but you don't see any people from Salton Sea.
You just see the industrialization of it.
Or the scientists people. I kind of wish we saw more of that, you know?
Yeah, I agree. I would like to learn about the people. But I do agree with you that, like, I don't mind if the subject matter is a bit bleak, like in Pipeline or whatever. It can be, but I think I've been spoiled by Daybreak a little bit, because I would like to see this game be more about how we do improve things, like how we do improve the process so it it isn't so bad for the environment and bad for the people that live there or work there.
Yeah, if it was a mechanical treatise, right? Like, that it showed via mechanisms how we could do this
right,
better.
Yeah, and it could say, you know, this isn't what is happening, but this could happen. You know, like, yeah. that's kind of how I feel. I want a little bit of hope and a little bit of something to cling to. I don't know.
Yeah, or just show how it could work, you know? How could we... You know, there's nothing about recycling lithium in the game mechanically,
again, that
right?
That would be something that a game... the game could be about,
yeah,
of okay, we don't currently recycle lithium because it's so expensive, but this is how we could do it more efficiently, this is how we could do it in a better way, so that it didn't have to be mined as much.
There's nothing about investing in the local area or the local community, you know, and if that was mechanically represented, it would have made for such a richer and more interesting game,
wouldn't it? Yeah, I totally agree.
So I don't really want to go back to Salton Sea anymore. It was, I liked the action selection mechanism, but the rest of the game I just feel like I want it to be in a different game. I want that idea of that your money is your actions to somehow be implemented in a more diverse, and that's mechanically speaking, you know, in a more diverse environment where, you know, you could approach the game in more different ways rather than like, well, I'll sell to corporations early on to make a profit and then I'll use that profit to fulfill contracts to, you know, get some victory points and then just go through this very granular process to grind out that money and or victory points.
Pro tip. If you take a contract early, don't try and fulfill it early because you will hamper yourself. that's what I'm going to say, because that's what I did. It's like, I'm going to take this contract and fulfill it so that, you know, it gives me the rewards early on. Oh, no, I'm not. Oh, no, I'm going to spend ages trying to do it and have no money. So don't do that. Don't do it, Elaine.
Nice.
Before we move on to our next game, Harry says, I've often thought about complexity or weight as it's usually presented in board games and how I'm not sure that it's a really useful way to know anything about a game. The following is purely anecdotal and the full reality is more nuanced than just my experience. I have found with board games, the best way to never have non-hardcore people play a game with you is to joke about how it's actually really complicated and that there's a lot going on. It's like telling someone about a book and only saying, well, it's really long and there's big words, you might have to look those up. I mean, the story is good once you get going, but like, it's a long book. Nobody is going to want to read that book. Obviously, people do have preferences on how long they want to play a game for and how much rules overhead they are willing to put up with, but it's not, as I feel like it's often presented the only or even most important thing. People want to play games that are interesting to them. Maybe it's the theme, maybe it's some mechanic that sounds cool, maybe it's just being social. It's a fine line between making a game sound interesting and lying about a game to get it to the table, but one that with practice you can navigate effectively. The real crux is, people, even non-gamer people, will put up with a lot more weight than they are often given credit for, as long as you don't make the game sound like a miserable experience.
I feel like there is the other side of that, where it's like, you can present the game really enthusiastically, you know, and be like, oh, this is a subject you're going to be really into because you like the subject, and then undersell just, you know, because some people just don't want the minutiae and intricacy that a lot of us, I think, who are enthusiasts for that hobby are really interested in and excited about. You're right in saying that it's hard to navigate this. It is, right? And tailoring board games, especially as introductions, you know, it's such a complex process, because we are often taught don't introduce with complex games. But then again, some people actually want the complexity. And if you introduce them with lighter games, they might be bored. Like, genuinely, they might think, oh, board games are cute, it's all right, you know, but, like, it's difficult, I agree in that, but I don't think there's even a clear-cut answer in this very inspired letter, by the way, I want to say, because it is clearly, you know, written from passion, you know, and personal experience. And I agree, sometimes you can introduce people to a kind of a wonderful time by pitching it through things that, you know, a person enjoys, right? It just reinforces my belief further that hosting board game nights is hard.
Hard
and like almost like an arcane art. You know, there are no clear-cut answers. There are shortcuts, but they're not universally applicable. It's like the free body problem, you know, like famously, oh, you can't solve this. Yes, you can. There's thousands of solutions to the free body problem. There's no universal solution, right? So It's like that.
If you have anything to say to us, it's elaine@nopunincluded.com. Let's talk about our second and last game of the episode. Arx comes from publisher Leader Games by designer Cole Worley with art by Kyle Ferrin.
Very important to know, this isn't just the first impressions. We haven't even got our copy of Arx yet, which we have purchased via the means of Kickstarter and will be coming when everyone's copies come. But we have played this 1.5 times on Tabletop Simulator with everyone's good friend Tom Brewster. So Tom is very enthusiastic about this game, and I'm sure their coverage of Arx will happen sometime very soon. I am eager and awaiting any word that Tom will have on Arx, because he is very enmeshed in the game, and I want to personally thank him for showing the game to us, because he showed us the game in a way that only an experienced person could, because he was enmeshed into the system. he was pulling out like all the tricks and stops, and I think it was just you and me pottering in the game, you know, and trying to explore it. We wouldn't have seen like a third of what we have seen by playing it with Tom. So thank you very much, Tom, for showing us Arx.
It was like having a tour guide.
Right? Yeah, yeah. So that was great. This is a first impressions, but first impressions from a very curated experience via TTS. And, you know, I'm sure we'll have more coverage of Arx ourselves in the future. So with all of that caveat, what is Arx? It is a game about space. Who is it designed by? Coley Worley. And what is it like? It is kind of like all of other Cole Worley's games.
But in space.
But in space, right? And what do I mean by that? Well, what I mean by that is that Cole Worley is a designer that creates systems that enmesh you in an environment in a way like no other games do. He is known for designing area control games, I suppose, wouldn't be like too far out, like out of a descriptor, because Root is definitely, you know, it has area control elements. Pax Premier has area control elements. I've not played John Company, but, you know, I imagine it has area control elements. Oath has area control elements. This is like that. It is definitely an area control game. You have this big space board, right, with space planets and space spaces, right? and you will have on these boards places where you build shipyards and then cities and then also spaceships. So there's like three different pieces you can have in this game. That's it, pretty much, right? And then you will move those spaceships into other areas. And there, it's not area control, it's technically like area majority, where like they'll coexist with other people's spaceships, but you can also attack them and remove them from the board and thus maybe free up space to build your own like cities, which are basically factories that produce a certain type of resource that the planet can produce. Now that descriptor is sort of, you know, like familiar to board games. The way it plays out is like nothing any other board game has done before, I feel. And there's touches of Cole Worley that you can see permeating through it. Like his design tropes are present, but also like I don't even know how to begin describing this game. I guess we can invoke the trick-taking aspect, right?
Right.
Because there's trick-taking in this game, right? But your first remark on playing Arx was,
it's nothing like trick-taking.
Right? Like, because it isn't. It uses trick-taking as a mechanism to do things.
Yeah, but I would not say to anybody, oh, this game has trick-taking in it. Like, I would say that it uses it as a mechanism to do other things, but it is not a game about trick taking.
Right. And it, and even the mechanism itself isn't like technically you win. You don't even win a trick. You can just respond in a trick, right?
Yeah, it's a very sort of tenuous link to the trick-taking genre.
Yeah. So there are four suits, or no, more. There are more than four suits, but there are suits of cards, right? And each suit denotes what type of actions this card can perform, right? And there are strengths of the suit, right? And one person will lead the trick, play one card, and then do the actions on that card that they wish to perform. And
or as many as they can. Yeah.
Yeah. So the strength of the suit will also determine like how many times you can do one of these actions, right?
Maybe.
Right. And then the people in clockwise order will then also play one card. If your card is higher, then you can perform also however many actions the card lets you perform.
Yes.
If your card is lower, you can perform
one,
right? If your card, you can then also play off suit, but like, yeah.
Then you still only get one action.
So technically, like the action is called copy, right? When you play a card that is lower of the same suit, you don't even play, you just play it face down. And then you will take one action from the lead card. So you don't have to even play the same type of card. You just play it face down. Or you can pivot. You can play any other card face up. And that way you get to do only one action of whatever your card says, right? So there's a weird dichotomy here where you're not trying to win the trick. It's just that someone led the trick. And they got to do whatever it is that they wanted to do. But then, if you played the same suit card and higher, you also get to do a bunch of the same action. And then you become first player and then lead the trick next round. So you get to do whatever you want to do.
Yeah, so it's just about being able to lead the trick next turn and potentially doing something else.
Yes.
Because you are leading the trick.
Exactly. So what can you do? Well, here's what you can do. You can build some ships. You can build some resources. You can move those ships. You can put influence on cards with special abilities that you can also, with a different action, then secure. If you have the most influence on that card, then you get like a cool special ability. You can attack another player in a really cool dice mechanism that I'll explain later. And that's kind of it, really, right? And again, it sounds simple, but the way these things work are very different. So, for example, resources. What do they do? Can you spend them to build more ships or whatever? No, you don't need to do that. You just build ships wherever you have shipyards. And that's kind of it. You don't need resources. But these resources stay on the board that you've acquired. And then you can spend them at the beginning of your turn, just before you play the card, to do like special actions, right? Like, so for example, you can do an action that your card otherwise wouldn't let you do. Like moving ships with fuel or building something with ore, I think, or whatever it was. But you can also like secure a card that you've put your influence on and all these other kinds of weird things, right? So resources are cool, but they also sit in this special space on your player board. When another player attacks you, they can steal these resources from you. So everything has these strange points of interaction that can be manipulated in various different ways. So you have little control over what action you can take. But unless you have the special resource that lets you do the same, right? Like,
there's a lot of ability to manipulate things.
Yeah, exactly. But in very specific, subtle ways. Yeah. And there are a lot of ways you can do that. In fact, there was one point where Tom did something. I can't even remember what it was because it was so specific. He did this sort of rules manipulation. And he was like, oh, but because of this rule and that rule and that rule. And I was like, get out of here. No. It's like you brought out this arcane law text and said, ah, yes, but, you know, rule 17B, stipulation C, article 5F.
Says a camel can be kicked in the hump on a Sunday.
Right, exactly. Uh-huh. Yeah, and I'm like, no. But... you know, and that's kind of the experience of playing ARX, I think, in a nutshell. You have these you have this like space setting, right? And you have these objectives, which I'll get to in a second, because I think that's kind of the most interesting part of the game. But to manipulate yourself into this position to be able to do what you want, you have to thread the finest thread through the finest needle and just somehow get it through, and a lot of it isn't in your control and the wind is blowing, you know, like that's arcs.
What a description.
I think I mangled it, but but like this is the best way I can describe it.
Yeah, I think it's quite a difficult game to give an overall description of, because there are so many different things in it that your goal of it really isn't necessarily what is happening in the game. So you were right in that it has area control and area majority, which is only important for certain specific situations. Like area control is only useful for when you are producing, when you're taxing your citizens and producing things, because that's how you will get the resources. Area majority is only useful for when you're fighting, because that is how you will potentially win a battle. And not necessarily, but you have a better chance if you have more ships in that area. So all of these different things work in very specific situations.
That's true. I like having more matters, because that says you have control of the area. But also, it doesn't mean you're boxed out of the area either if you don't have as... But the weird part where it all comes together is the goals that are present each round. These are the things that will score you victory points. And much like in Root, you go to about 30. I think it's mutable based on player count.
Mm-hmm. It is.
But the way you determine what is important is playing a card with a certain strength. So it's a 2 or a 5 or a 6, you know? And then leading with that card and then saying, I am making the value of this card 0. Mm-hmm. But in this round, we will now be scoring for this thing. The first thing that is declared like that is 5 victory points, then 3, then 2. But those victory point values change as well.
Yes, because
as
the lowest one flips to its other side to make it higher.
So for example, whoever has the most material and fuel in terms of resources can get 5 victory points at the end of the round. And so you play the card that enables that. I think that's the 2, right?
Well, that's the interesting thing, because while there are different suits, and each suit does a similar thing, it has similar actions on it, the number is what determines the end of round scoring ability.
But only if you lead with it.
And
declare it.
Declare it, yeah.
Yeah, which then lets the other person definitely surpass all the other players, surpass if they have the right suit card, and get more actions, right?
Maybe, yeah.
Which is again a bizarre interaction, and then, you know, like you've declared that as an important thing, but you have to maintain that, right? And this is where the game gets really funky and really interesting, right? So in a first game, you have declared that indeed having the most fuel and material is what's going to get you 5 victory points at the end of the round. I'm like, cool. I'm going to bid on this card that says I control all the unused fuel resources.
Rather than stand on the board, they come to you.
Yeah, and it counts as like me having them for the end of the round, which is sweet, right? Except that it's the ones that are not controlled by other players, because they can still get fuel, like they can produce fuel, and when they produce fuel they take it
steal it from me
and suddenly I have less. So that card is important, but then someone can come in the ships with into a like territory where I have a city, right, and attack that city, and then if they roll the right kind of dice they can steal that card from me that gives me that special ability. And this is a really cool mechanism. So whenever you attack another player, right, you get a choice of which dice you roll. There's blue dice, red dice, and orange dice, right? So blue dice are like the lowest risk. And this is a really cool mechanism as well, because when you attack someone, you roll all the dice and you assign, like the defender has nothing that they can decide on, right? You literally make all the decisions. You choose which dice you roll. So bluest are the lowest risk. They probably have some blanks and some hits, right? But, like, you don't do a lot of damage, And they have certain uses. The red ones have more hits, but they can also do damage to your own ships. Okay, right? The orange ones are the really funky ones because they have this circle result, which means that you can, like, sustain damage to your own ships equal to the total enemy force, which is a lot, right? Depending on who you're attacking. Like, they're high risk, high reward. But also, they have key results, which are the things that let you steal from your opponent. You can only roll the orange ones if you're attacking an enemy city, so it's important where you are. And the best die is, like, the one that gives you two keys, but also has the circle around the keys. So, like, you get to steal something, but you've just been blasted to death. It's very bizarre and weird and fun because hubris is just ever persistent in those dice.
What I found really interesting was the decision of when you wanted to make your card zero and claim a scoring condition. Because if you did it, if you waited too long, then they might all be gone because there's only three. And the scoring condition that you were eyeing up might be out of the question, out the, you know, round. But if you do it too early, then everyone will look at it and go, oh, that's what I need to get in order to score. I'm going to go for that. And then everyone piles on and tries to do the same thing. And you end up going, oh, well, okay, but I can't do that after all because this is too hard now. And so that was really cool because there were a couple of times where I thought, I'm on a good path to be able to do this, to score well. So I claimed the scoring condition and then everyone just outdid me.
Well, it's this ecosystem where you have plans within plans within plans okay, so fuel is important. Okay, if I get the card that says fuel cartel, I control the fuel. Okay, but someone can steal the card. Okay, so I need to protect myself from that. Okay, there's a card that's like, stops
someone from stealing a card.
They have to steal this card first.
Yeah.
Okay, but like, it's not ironclad protection, so maybe I can like manipulate the trick taking in some way, right? Then there's this other thing where, like, you know, every card you play is technically like a chance to do actions, right? But you can play two cards in one go, just give up one card entirely, which means like the last round of actions in the round, basically. You will not get to partake in, right? But you get to steal initiative. So you're the one who's leading the tricks. And, you know, maybe if you have a lot of one suit, other players don't have that suit. They can't steal, you know, being first. So you're always leading what's happening. And there is wheels within wheels within wheels within wheels. And right. You're never in full control.
Right. If you do have something really tasty and you get that card that says you can't steal any card, then you are incentivizing someone to attack you more than once. So then you are thinking, okay, how do I make my ships pretty strong so that if they do attack me, or how do I move them to an area that I don't have a city in so that they can't, like, they can't steal the cards from me. Like, there is so much to think about.
There is a lot to think about. But also, so here's where I kind of feel about the game a little bit. You know, I enjoyed ARX greatly, but there is that element of which is so I was in the Atlantic. There was a profile on Cole Worley that I was interviewed for, and he was quoted in the profile, and it's something that the person who wrote the article also kind of mentioned when he was interviewing me. It's like that Cole Worley doesn't like to design games that evoke fun or something like that. I don't want to misquote it, right? But like, fun is not the primary objective, right? It's, I think this, you know, storytelling maybe, you know, is the primary objective, and the strange intricate mechanisms that create an environment that, you know, tell a story. So I could feel that happening in ARX, but also what I could feel happening is that lack of control, where sometimes towards the end of the game, you know, you kind of know what you want to do. And I felt that much more strongly in PAX Pamir Second Edition. But like, you know what you want to do, but the Byzantine system of cards, the way it sort of all fell together, you know, from this house of cards into a pile, like, you can't find the right thing in the pile. You technically know what you want to reach for, right? But you just can't extract it, right? And at times, I think, towards the end of the game, we were facing a situation where we were, just playing cards because we had to play cards to do things, but we knew that they weren't going to produce any kind of effect that had any relevancy on the game. And we were waiting for that critical moment where something critical would happen, or maybe it wouldn't, because it would be bad if it happened, right? But the tension was deflated, I think. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I suppose, but doesn't that always happen when you are dealt random cards? So sometimes you're dealt cards that you think, these really work for what I want to do, and sometimes you're dealt cards where you are waiting for someone else to play the card so that you can copy it, if that is a mechanism in the game.
I mean, in a trick-taking game, sure. That's often persistent. You got dealt a bad hand of cards. What
but
are you going to do?
Just in trick-taking, yeah. In any game that has cards that have actions on that you are dealt or that you draw, there are always going to be turns where you have to kind of pivot away from what you thought you wanted to do because you just won't be able to do it.
That's true. And also I think the benefit of arcs has, because there are so many bylaws, right, that you can sort of try and weave something out of it, you know, invoke some sort of rule that pivots you into a slightly more beneficial situation. But on the flip side of that, sometimes you can sit there and be like, I have no control over what is happening. And I didn't even put myself into this position. It just, the confluence of things happened in such a way where it tells a story, but in terms of agency, you don't get agency.
But maybe that is part of the story.
Right, yeah. But I think it's worth bringing that up because I think, you know, there is a very distinct lack of agency, and sometimes sitting in a game and experiencing it rather than engaging in it, you know, is something that people don't necessarily want to do, right? It's like watching a Rube Goldberg machine work rather than building the Rube Goldberg machine yourself. Does that make sense?
Is that how you felt?
I think at times I feel that generally in Cold Worldies games, yes.
You were just watching the marble go along and hoping that the bucket fell down to make the dominoes clack.
Exactly.
Windmill go around or whatever. That's how you felt?
Yeah,
that you didn't have much control over...
Towards the end of the game,
But I think that sometimes happens in games anyway, because you've already built up what you're doing. And you know, in Euro games where, you know, you've tried to build up your engine and gain resources and get things and do things and get yourself in a certain position within the game. And if you haven't managed to do that, then that house of cards does fall down. Whereas if you have, and I think that is part of the puzzle, isn't it, of any game, really, of trying to get to a point where the machine just works itself. Sometimes, not all games, obviously, but sometimes that can be part of the fun of a game, is that you are just then watching it play out. And I don't agree with you that I found that boring. I still felt like I had things to do and that I could manipulate things.
I didn't find it boring. I found it frustrating. I think at no point have I found ARGs boring. I think, just to countermand a lot of what I said, there was so much excitement happening in the game at all times. So first of all, the trick-taking part is exciting. What do you have in your hand? Are you going to play the right card? That's really exciting. Then there's the cards with special abilities that you kind of bid influence on and try to secure. The abilities on those cards are break the rules of the game in really, really crunchy, interesting ways, and often bring a lot of liveliness, and excitement. The fact that you can steal them from other players, that's exciting. The fact that you have to bid on them and then wait a turn and then secure them, that's really exciting. What they do, exciting.
But you're right, that can also be quite frustrating because, I understand what you mean.
Yeah, I think this is, in a way, the most rewarding and the most freewheeling of his games, because there's so much of it that just is fun. You know, the dice are fun, the cards are fun, the manipulation of resources is fun, the stealing is fun.
it is kind of on the edge of your seat sometimes, where you're really hoping that someone doesn't do the thing that you don't want them to do because you want to do the thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, if you are trying to claim a card and you've put your influence on it, and then you're really hoping that no one else does that because you really want that card, and then they come along and put more influence on it than you've got, and you think, oh no, because then they have the potential to steal that card, whereas you don't anymore. You don't have the possibility to take that card because they have more influence on it than you.
And you have no way of guaranteeing, like, that you will be able to do the action to put influence again, right? Or maybe the person who put more influence on your card dug their own grave because they've just played the card that enables that action, and you can play a card that lets you do more of that.
Like, I suppose there is that about it as well, that you kind of sometimes trick someone into doing something because you're like, well, if I put these here, you might do this, and then I've got this. Because I think the thing that you were talking about when you said about Tom came up with this arcane rule, like that we needed to know, was when I had, I think, 6 influence on one of the cards, and I thought, I am absolutely going to secure this, and then with some twist of a magic wand, he was like, no, you don't. I'm having this card. I can't remember what the actual
It's not that he won the card, it's that he won the card and all the, like, agents, the influence agents that you put on it, went to his jail area and that was the scoring condition, so suddenly was winning the or something like that. And I was like, oh, okay, with one fell stroke, not only did you get the card, but also, like, got yourself more victory points because of, like, oh, but, like, when you do this happens.
I think it probably is a game that you get better at the more you play, because you learn all of these intricate details
and nifty tricks,
and you don't make the same mistakes again.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot to learn. Talking of storytelling as well, I do want to say that the way it feels is so different to other games in terms of storytelling, because I think in a lot of space games, what you have is, like, you are, you know, it's that weird ancient term 4X, you know, you expand, explore, blah, blah, blah. So many games follow that mechanical formula. It's like, I have a hexagon, I build ships on it, those ships go out, they secure other areas, I build on those areas, they make more ships, they go out, I have bigger area, I will get technology,
they make resources.
Right, like, it's that sort of trudge. This feels nothing like that, and consequentially the story is the nothing like that. It makes you feel a lot more like a character in a space opera rather than like some sort of an overarching mastermind. You know, like, of you don't play like a nation, you play a person, a privateer, or you know, maybe a smuggler, or maybe, you know, like some sort of criminal lord, or like you're one of these characters. You're not all of these characters, and there's an evolution to your character as well, right? So we had a peek at how the campaign works, and so the weird thing about Arx is that you can play it as a one-off game, but with an expansion, you can play it as a sequence of free games, and that's nice. A campaign of free games, I you know, it's definitely a selling point. But also there's this, like, then role assigned to your character, and it kind of, like, narratively puts you in a specific kind of scope and a specific kind of story. And then it lets you pivot from that story based on how well you do in the first game or whatever, and then lets you pivot again. That looks very interesting, and I can't wait to get my hands on an actual physical copy of both of these systems and explore more of that, because I have a sneaking suspicion that the game becomes even more interesting and even more peculiar when you play it as a free game campaign. But so far, I don't know. I'm very intrigued by it. It's definitely a game that, A, feels different, B, feels weird, C, approaches the space opera narrative in board games from an actual narrative direction, rather from, like, you are a nation, go conquer lands, you know? And it also has these points of tension that I don't always jive with, you know, moments of frustration where you're like, I know what story I want to tell. I'm kind of, you know, but the game doesn't let me paint that story. It wants to, like, almost deliberately not give me control to tell its own story, right? And sometimes that produces better emergent narrative, right? And I recognize that, but I just wish I had a little bit more agency in that.
I understand. I'm really looking forward to playing the campaign as well. I feel like we've done the groundwork. We've learned how to play the game. I'm ready for the proper story now.
Me too. You will have more on Arx as time goes by, but for now, these are our very early impressions.
That's all the games for this episode. Thank you so much for listening. And Efka, what is on the bonus episode this week and where can people find it?
They can find it by going to patreon.com/nopunincluded and becoming a supporter of No Pun Included and Talk Cardboard. And you'll have access to all the bonus episodes we've released so far. On this bonus episode, we are not reviewing any more games. What? We are actually having a little reflection on our trip to Germany and an event organized by the Spiel des Jahres organization called Board Game Criticism Day. This was an event aimed at German board game reviewers. However, they kindly invited us as guests and had me as a keynote speaker and also had us host a seminar that we called What Do We Owe Our Audience? And we want to reflect on that seminar and some of the things that we discussed on it and presented in it and some of the ideas posited by the people who attended the seminar, because I thought those were very interesting. The event very much had an ethos of injecting new life into board game journalism, and I think it's an important subject and a subject that's kind of important to us as we're, you know, not only board game journalists, I guess, technically reviewers, that's a journalism, right? I guess it answers, you know, it deals with that question, right? But we're often, you know, outspoken for criticizing board games as media rather than just as board games, and that was the focus of the entire event as well. So we want to talk about that.
I'm not even going to ask you what the game of the episode was.
It's Arx, because it's Arx, because we didn't like Salt and Sea, so Arx. And with that, why don't you say goodbye, Elaine?
Goodbye, Elaine.
Goodbye, Elaine.